This week on the Backtable Podcast.
After they did the embolization, they readministered the questionnaires for the painful bladder syndrome, interstitial cystitis, and the orthostatic hypotension to those patients, and they saw dramatic decreases in the severity of the symptoms reported on those questionnaires with regard to the orthostatic patients at the same level that the best possible treatment for orthostatic hypotension, which is saline infusions weekly, can cause. So there's some interesting data here to sort of tickle your mind. You know, it's nothing conclusive at this point, but it certainly gets at the possible commonality of potentially etiology of maybe these conditions, chronic pelvic pain and interstitial cystitis and orthostatic hypotension, but certainly the coexistence of these symptoms, which may, at least at 6-month follow-up, and to some extent, these patients were also followed at a year, improvement in these associated symptoms.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Backtable Podcast, your source for all things interventional and endovascular. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and on backtable.com. Now, a brief message from our sponsor. Cook Medical's diverse portfolio of embolization coils may help you meet both clinical and cost goals at the same time in the same procedure. All of Cook Medical's embolization coils are fibered to promote quick occlusion. Two published animal studies, the first authored by Dr. Scott Teratola in 2019 and the second by Dr. Sarah White in 2023, were designed to examine the role of fiber in peripheral vessel occlusion in arteries and veins, respectively. Both studies show that fibers on coils may reduce the number of coils required to occlude peripheral vessels. Both studies can be found on jvir.org. In addition, choose from Cook Medical's range of hand-shaped microcatheters to deliver embolization coils to target anatomy. Find out how Cook Medical can support your embolization procedures from start to finish with devices that fit your clinical needs and preferences. To learn more, reach out to your local rep today, visit cookmedical.com, or follow Cook Vascular on X and LinkedIn. Now, back to the episode.
Today, we've got a great episode. We're going to be discussing embolization practices in pelvic venous disorders, also known as pelvic congestion syndrome. We're going to kind of talk a little bit about the lingo and how that's changed also and over the years. For our audience who wants to catch other relevant episodes, we just released one, episode 389, on pelvic physical therapy with Ingrid Harm Hernandez. She's a pelvic floor physical therapist talking about how these patients present in her practice and how she works closely with interventional radiologists to get these patients treated. So that's an interesting one to catch. And then episode 337, we had Brooke Spencer on. She talked about vulvar varices and how she approaches those. And then going kind of way back a few years ago, we had Michael Cumming and Mark Meisner on. It's a cross-collaborative discussion on how they approach pelvic venous disease as well. But here with us today, I'm very pleased to announce, to introduce our guest, Neil Kilanani. Welcome to the show, Neil. I'm really excited to have you on and explore this topic. Again, dive deep in some areas in terms of how you approach this and also clear up some of the maybe misconceptions out there. Neil, what I'd like to start out with is just an introduction, where you're at and what your practice looks like today.
Sure. Well, first off, thanks again for inviting me and shining a light again on pelvic venous disorders. I really do think this is something we need to be talking about a lot as interventional radiologists. I think we can make a big impact in caring for patients. So I'm a professor of clinical radiology at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian Hospital here in New York City. My practice is primarily peripheral, if you will, or superficial venous disease in the lower extremities, although I do see a fair number of patients with post-thrombotic disease as well. And as a spin-off of that, I interface with a lot of women with pelvic origin lower extremity varicose veins and have over the years developed a clinical interest and a research interest in taking care of patients with that problem, and then also ultimately morphing into taking care of patients with venous origin chronic pelvic pain. And so that sort of summarizes myself. I work in a group with three other members or partners of my team who are also physicians interested in lower extremity venous disorders, and two of them are particularly interested in venous origin chronic pelvic pain. So we have a pretty robust practice dealing with that.
Fantastic. Thank you for that intro. And so it's a great segue for the trainees that are listening. I wanted you to tell us a little bit about the process of pelvic venous disease, how these patients typically present. And then for myself, who I've been in practice for 10 years, I learned it as pelvic congestion syndrome, but it sounds like that terminology is kind of morphed or changed into this sort of broader reaching pelvic venous disease. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, just the link, the terminology?
Absolutely. Well, first off, maybe for the students and the residents who are participating, just to lay sort of a conceptual background on all of this. The pelvic venous system is primarily drained by the internal iliac veins and the ovarian veins, and then secondarily by the common iliac vein and inferior vena cava, as well as the left renal vein. And so disorders, whether they're reflux or obstruction in any of these venous systems, can lead to what we'll call pelvic venous disorder, sort of a global term that will include many of the clinical presentations and pathophysiology that used to fall under much of that syndromic nomenclature that we would encourage people to discard, and pelvic venous congestion, nutcracker syndrome, May-Thurner syndrome, and even a term pelvic dumping syndrome are these older terms that I think don't help us and may distract from what we're trying to do. Ultimately, obstruction or reflux can lead to venous hypertension in the pelvis, and venous in the hypertension in the pelvis can lead to a variety of different clinical presentations based on how the pressure caused by the reflux and obstruction is managed. So if we consider the pelvic veins themselves, there are really three venous reservoirs, so to speak, in the pelvis, and in the what will include the renal hilum as part of the pelvis. And so the renal hilum is one of those reservoirs. The pelvic veins are a second reservoir. That's all the venous plexi that are in the pelvis, the ovarian, periuterine, perivaginal, and pericystic around the bladder venous reservoirs. The third reservoir that we would consider in the pelvis are what we'll maybe better call transitional veins. So these are the veins that are connecting those with the pelvis with those with what's outside the pelvis. And so specifically the vulva in women, the scrotum in men is part of that system, and the perineal gluteal areas where varicose veins can develop with reflex through these so-called pelvic escape points. And maybe a fourth reservoir could be considered the reservoir of the lower extremity. So depending on how the reflux and the obstruction is managed, you can get different types of clinical presentations. And the way I like to sort of upfront state this is that there are four basic clinical presentations of pelvic venous disorders. The one that gets most of the attention and the one that we should probably spend most of our time talking about today is venous origin chronic pelvic pain. And we'll get more into the details of how that looks and how you diagnose it and maybe how to treat it later in the talk. But that would be one. The other main one that we see are what we can call lower extremity varicose veins of pelvic origin. So these are the varicosities that develop in the labia or the ones that develop in the inner thighs and gluteal areas in women. We can also include scrotal varicosities as part of that too. And then the other clinical presentations are a little less common, at least in the practices that are dealing with chronic pelvic pain, but what we can consider venous origin pain in the kidney or the left kidney, so left flank pain and associated with a venous origin, and also left flank or left kidney derived hematuria and proteinuria, maybe a third presentation. And then the fourth presentation could be left lower extremity swelling or venous claudication, which can occur often with thrombotic iliac obstruction, which could be classified as a pelvic venous disorder, but with non-thrombotic causes of iliac occlusion. So I think we can tie the pelvic venous anatomy and pathophysiology well using that specific construct with the construct of how to look at pelvic presentations of venous disorders the way that I just laid out.
Perfect. Thank you for explaining all that. When we talk about commonality or I guess the prevalence, can you kind of order those in terms of what you're seeing? I mean, it sounds like the first one seems to be most common, but is there a percentage that we can assign to that in terms of the general female population?
Yeah, it's very hard to say. And I guess it depends on, you know, how we're looking at it. If we're looking at what the fraction of chronic pelvic pain may be venous in origin, there's one study that gives us some insight into that. And this is a pretty old study done by a gynecologist in 2001 using clinical exam, ultrasound, venography, which was done transfundally, which we could talk about if you're interested, where a needle gets put into the myometrium through the cervix and contrast is injected and images taken. And then with laparoscopy, this particular physician from Turkey, Dr. Soysal, estimated it about somewhere around 30% of women with chronic pelvic pain may have a primary venous origin, and another 10% of patients with other causes of chronic pelvic pain may also have a venous etiology or at least a venous contribution of their pain. In terms of how often we see these kind of patients, it's a little harder for me to sort of give you a statement on, only because everybody's practices are so different and selection bias plays a big role there. I think roughly, the estimate is roughly 10% of women with lower extremity varicose veins will have venous origin, or pelvic origin rather, varicosities as their primary varicosities. But just anecdotally, from my own clinical experience and from others, if you look for these varicose veins in women in reproductive age, you're going to find them in a large fraction of patients. They may be smaller and less important and may happen concurrently with other problems, but they're pretty prevalent.
Especially after pregnancy, right? I mean, it seems like pregnancy can lead to postpartum chronic pelvic congestion. Is there any percentages around that?
There aren't any good percentages, but certainly the more pregnancies, the more expressed these venous origin, or sorry, pelvic origin varicosities in the lower extremity and in the labia develop. Certainly with one or two pregnancies, it's less, and with four or five pregnancies, it's a lot. Definitely during pregnancy, these varicose veins can get quite large and become quite symptomatic. What's pretty remarkable is how much better the lower extremity pelvic origin varicosities get within the first 6 to 12 weeks postpartum. And so we get consulted with a lot of women who are very uncomfortable and gynecologists who are a little worried about how they look and how they're feeling because of their lower extremity varicosities of pelvic origin during their pregnancies. And we counsel them to be conservative and to expect improvement postpartum and to come back and see us 6 to 12 weeks after delivery if they're still uncomfortable or worried about their veins.
That sounds like a whole another topic that we won't go down that road, but interesting though. And so to go back to your OBGYN colleagues who are probably the ones referring these patients to you, is that how they typically present, or are you having patients reach, given your expertise, reach directly out to you? Can you tell us a little bit about your referral system and how these patients are coming to you?
Yeah, and it's going to vary by practice, and our practice will sort of just give an idea of maybe one way things flow. So we certainly get from our gynecology colleagues a lot of patients who have varicosities after having several children in their legs. And that's probably the most common referral we get from gynecologists. There are a few gynecologists who send us patients who have chronic pelvic pain, but most of those patients that we're getting who have chronic pelvic pain are either coming self-referred or coming from a PMNR physician who has clinical expertise in taking care of women with pelvic pain. And those two PMNR physicians will refer very liberally patients to us with suspected venous origin chronic pelvic pain, often in a consultative nature. Hey, what do you think? I see these veins in the pelvis, they have pain. Do you think they're related? And then, as you had mentioned at in the opening comments, there are some pelvic physiotherapists who also refer patients to us. And I think that is where a lot of our patients, meaning I shouldn't say our patients, but patients who have venous origin chronic pelvic pain may be getting their treatment and being sort of underappreciated as maybe somebody who could potentially benefit from a venous intervention.
I want to go back to the terminology for a minute, because when you're having these conversations with these referring docs, whether it be a GYN or PMNR, are they using dated terminology and you find yourself sort of at a disconnect, or is everybody seem to be on the same page with how you talk about these disorders?
Yeah, I don't think our new nomenclature has made it into the gynecologic world, and I don't think most gynecologists appreciate the relationship between venous disorder and pelvic pain. And so there's very rarely a connection. And in fact, I think in many ways, the term pelvic congestion syndrome is almost a trigger word, because if you say it, I think it automatically closes the concept down. And that's why I really do think we need to get away from that term. I think it carries baggage and it hurts us in our efforts to promote this, both at a scientific level, a societal level, but also on a patient-by-patient level.
You're right. That's why I asked that question, because when I was in the OBL setting and going out and talking to some OB-GYN colleagues about fibroids, about pelvic congestion, it seemed like they didn't really want to talk about pelvic congestion. And sometimes, oftentimes, we kind of debate whether it was truly something real. And I was always like, just send me your pelvic pain patients and we'll work them up with imaging, right? And we can see if there's something that could be done. And again, I think you're right that there's something that kind of triggers in their mind that docs are just going to go coil something and it's not like really fixing the problem. Did you experience that over the last several years or seeing that in the community?
No, absolutely. I mean, just sort of anecdotally, my wife is a gynecologist and there's no discussion about veins as a cause of chronic pelvic pain in the general gynecologic community. And whatever is said is very skeptical. There's the concept, and I think this is a reasonable argument to make, that they see pelvic varicosities frequently, whether it's during pregnancy, as we discussed already, at the time of delivery, or, you know, even postpartum, but even in the gynecologic community, when they're doing procedures for other reasons, you know, they'll find big veins if they're in a, let's say, doing laparoscopy and they haven't insufflated or Trendelenburg the patient so much, and the patients often won't have a clinical problem that signals that the veins are related to it. And I think that's reasonable because I think not everybody with dilated veins is going to have a chronic pelvic pain condition. When they bring that up, I think a reasonable thing to bring up with them is the analogy with endometriosis, because a large fraction of patients with endometriosis are asymptomatic. You'll find endometriosis surprisingly frequently on gynecologic surgery for other causes. And I think when you make that connection, I think gynecologists are aware that even the science behind endometriosis and how causal it is for pain is not so strong. It opens their mind up a little bit more to the idea that some patients with big veins are going to be asymptomatic and some are going to be symptomatic. And thinking about how to identify those who are symptomatic who might benefit from a treatment of their veins is something that resonates.
Yeah. The patients I got were always the ones where they just couldn't figure it out. The patient kept coming back with pain and they say, Aaron, you know, I don't know what, I've ruled everything else out. Can you just take a look and see if they truly do have some sort of pelvic insufficiency or venous disorder? And so that's how I always kind of was able to get those conversations going with the gynecologist. Just like, do you have any patients that you can't find a cause for the pelvic pain? I feel like that was a good entry point.
No, these are difficult patients to take care of, and they're struggling. A lot of times you'll find a number of things wrong with these patients. You being the gynecologist in this case, we'll find a number of things wrong, and then they have to try to figure out what's the most impactful thing to treat, or should several things be treated? And then on top of all of that, there's often some psychological issues that go on. You know, these are sort of typical in patients with chronic pain of any condition. So if you think about somebody with chronic back pain or chronic hip pain, there's often depression, there's catastrophizing, there's central sensitization that goes on. So they're struggling with the side effects of all those secondary issues as well. And so their logic is they just peel, it's like peeling an onion, trying to get to the core of what the problem is, take a layer off at a time, treat something, see if you get benefit, then treat something else. And I think in that context, they should be considering veins, and that's a very appropriate way to approach them.
Yeah. Well, that leads to my next question, which is, once they do send you a patient or a patient presents to you with these symptoms, what's your workup? Walk us through that.
Yeah. And, you know, the workup does vary, and there's no strong evidence-based way to approach this. I do think partnerships with chronic pelvic pain providers, and I guess specifically in this case, usually gynecologists, is very helpful, because I do think the physical exam contributes to the specificity of the diagnosis. And I think, like any other health condition, we should get to a place where ultimately it's going to be the history, it's going to be the physical exam, and then confirmatory imaging findings that make a diagnosis. We shouldn't just have somebody come in who has some undefined pain syndrome and happens to have big veins in the pelvis and make the connection. We'll probably be right in many of those cases, but we'll be right more of those cases if a good physical exam by a thoughtful gynecologist who's taken the time to go through all of the potential possibilities is done. But in general, with patients who presumably have had good physical exams and have had thoughtful exclusion of some of the more typical non-venous causes of pain, the history is really important. And I think the signals in the history that tell us that there's a venous cause generally relate to gravity-related symptoms. And so there, the patients will say things like, the pain is fine in the morning, but by the end of the day, I'm very uncomfortable. And it's kind of a dull, aching pressure that gets worse when I'm more active, when I'm lifting things, when I'm bending over. It gets better when I lie down. Other features that they'll describe will be things like prolonged postcoital pain. The dyspareunia, a little more noisy, but dyspareunia is also part of this. But the signaling kind of thing is pain that lasts for a long time, days sometimes, but certainly many more hours than is typical for the sort of entry dyspareunia, which is more the typical dyspareunia, which is quite common in patients. Physical exam findings that support the diagnosis of a pelvic venous disorder are tenderness over the ovary, tenderness over the uterus and cervix, particularly tenderness that reproduces the kind of pain that the patient has. So most of us IRs and vascular interventionalists who don't do the appropriate kind of exam, bimanual exam, that would be the one that would lead to the kind of physical exam findings I just suggested. But we can do what's called an ovarian point pressure exam. In other words, a point one-third of the distance from the umbilicus to the anterior superior iliac spine is typically over the ovary. And if we push there and we can reproduce the pain, that's got a high sensitivity and specificity along with some of the other historical findings that we talked about to identify women with venous origin chronic pelvic pain. And then there's imaging confirmation of the findings of the presumed venous origin of the chronic pelvic pain. And there's really no evidence-based way to approach this. Certainly, transvaginal ultrasound, transabdominal ultrasound, CT and MRI can all be used. CT, MRI, and transabdominal ultrasound have the advantage of being able not only to identify pelvic varicosities in the periuterine, periovarian plexus, but arcuate varicosities going through the uterus, which are particularly important. But they also can assess the iliac veins, and they can also assess the renal veins. And particularly ultrasound can look at the physiology of those veins and look at the velocities, and maybe ultimately the best way to, as a vascular interventionalist, evaluate the patients who are coming to you referred specifically for possible venous origin chronic pelvic pain, because you can get into the physiologic assessment of them. We can certainly do that with dynamic CT. We can certainly get a little bit more information with either phase contrast or contrast-enhanced dynamic MR imaging, but the ultrasound does have that specific advantage. Ultimately, I think transvaginal ultrasound is going to play a big role in this. Certainly at the gynecologic level, it's used very frequently to evaluate patients with chronic pelvic pain, and I think it will become an important screening test looking for dilated tortuous plexus-related varicosities and enlarged arcuate veins. And then along with the appropriate history, serve as the trigger for a referral to a vascular specialist to evaluate the patient to see if there's a treatment worth considering.
So you listed the different imaging modalities that you have at hand. Is there one thing that you preferred? Are you saying basically just depends, body habitus, patient's presentation, that sort of thing, on what you would start with? I mean, ultrasound, obviously, it's easy. It's usually in an office. It's cheap. Do you start there and then move into the cross-sectional imaging?
Yeah, one of the challenges, and particularly in the vascular interventional community, is the lack of appreciation of the value of transabdominal ultrasound. And I think it has to do a bit with skill and patience. You can definitely image the iliac veins with high reliability and on a routine basis. One thing to keep in mind is that the patients who are typically affected by venous origin chronic pelvic pain have low BMI. That's been shown in studies. And so low BMI patients who are brought in the morning before they've had a chance to eat or drink anything with less bowel gas, you can do a very good study. And there's a nice paper by Nikos Labropoulos in Phlebology that goes through the technique of how to do this ultrasound. Now, this ultrasound may take longer than a standard sort of transabdominal. Are there fibroids? Are there no fibroids? Is there an ovarian mass or not? And it requires special expertise in the technologist as well as in the interpreting physician. But it's ultimately going to be something worth pursuing. I think, as you mentioned, it could be done in the office at the same time the patient comes in. And it could really help figure out what's going on. And it can also be a great teaching tool for the patient to see, you know, look how tight your left common iliac vein is because this artery is on top of it, pressing it against the spine. And look at all these varicosities in your pelvis that nobody ever knew about before. It really helps enlighten and helps everybody have a better understanding of what's going on, and ultimately will be the very cost-effective way to image. But not everybody has that experience. Not everybody experience meaning to do these scans technically and interpretively. And so I think what works for you is best. And I think CT and MR can work very well as well. But I think ultimately, from a cost point of view to society, and maybe even from a radiation exposure point of view, getting toward transabdominal ultrasound as your vascular workup tool will be a desirable endpoint.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it all depends on the experience of your tech and how good they are at finding these things and if they've had the adequate training. The other thing that's challenging is the CT venogram, right? Just being able to time it correctly, get the kind, and those technologists being trained at that and having a good protocol. Hemodynamics can change that. So we always kind of, whenever there's suspicion of something, you would kind of jump to the MRI just because that would seem to be most definitive. But maybe can you elaborate on that and maybe how people can improve their, obviously ultrasound tech, you can get your technologists some better training, but any suggestions for CT venograms?
Yeah, CT venogram I tend not to use, although I'll say if we look nationally at what is used most, I think it is used more than MR, partially because people are more likely to get the information as non-radiologists from that than they are from the MR, partially because of the training and the sort of protocols that are being used, and also expertise availability. We have a very robust MR protocol practice, and it's actually both CT and MR are done by, for this particular indication, are done by the interventional radiologists in our group. And we love MR for this, MR particularly with contrast. And yes, the time-resolved images that can be done, you know, depending whether you have, you know, GE, Philips, they're all going to be named different things, but Siemens, but the time-resolved pictures can be really impactful in the way that we present what we see to our colleagues and to our patients. But I tend to rely on the post-contrast, and we'll just describe in the Siemens lingo, LAVA images, or rather GE lingo, where we have steady-state imaging with high resolution because of the contrast being around. And I tend to view them axially, and I get a lot of information in terms of the size of the ovarian veins, the size of the what the renal vein and the iliac vein looks like, common iliac vein, but also it's a great way to see the pelvic varicosities both inside the uterus and, or, you know, in the plexi around the uterus. So that's kind of our approach. We are developing the experience with ultrasound. We had a tech who was very good at it, and it was hard to find somebody to replace her when she left. And now we have another tech, and between myself and one of the other physicians who's very interested in promoting ultrasound, we're getting her up to speed, and we're sort of doing a hodgepodge of both ultrasound and MRI to evaluate these patients.
Neil, what I'd like to do next is maybe if we walk through a couple scenarios where you see the abnormal findings, let's say it's a dilated, a very large ovarian vein with some, and or very large ovarian vein with compression of the iliac vein. How often are you seeing one and not the other, or both?
Yeah, I think the prevalence of left common iliac vein compression is so high that you often see both together. And so the sort of challenge here is to determine which is the more significant problem. I think we can get into the discussion of the nuances of how to distinguish one from the other, but quite honestly, at this point, there isn't a lot of evidence to guide us. It is important for everybody to recognize how prevalent the left common iliac vein compression can be. A 50% diameter compression is seen in more than a third of people who come in for CT scans for any reason. And the same is true even for renal vein compression. Somewhere between a third and half of patients who get imaged for other issues will have more than a 50% compression of their left renal vein. So these compressive phenomena, we won't call them diseases, are common. And so when you do find evidence of ovarian vein or internal iliac vein incompetence, you often see it in concert with sometimes less significant levels of the compressions of these problems, which makes it easy if it's just a subtle or even just a 50% compression, and the reflux seems to be the dominant problem, and the symptoms fit those of reflux, then the reflux approaches, or the reflux pathophysiology may be the more dominant one in that particular patient. But yeah, this is tricky, and it's going to take a little time for us to tease out the best way to go at trying to distinguish them. But there's certainly some features, and we can get into that if you'd like, that may help.
Yeah, I guess once you see these abnormal findings, what's your conversation with the patient to just lay out treatment options?
Yeah, you know, I think often I'll try to, in my head, determine what's the, you know, sort of the cause. You know, what do I think is the most common cause? And my discussion will follow that logic. So the patient has a big ovarian vein, but it looks like it's refluxing. Then we'll go down the reflux discussion and, you know, sort of just mention that there is this other thing and or these other things, you know, iliac and renal vein compressions, and we would work those out, but we're not sure. This is where the pre-procedural imaging actually helps a lot. I think we need to do this, or at least think about this more. But if you can do an ultrasound ahead of time and see that there is a iliac vein compression, but when you sit the patient up, that iliac vein compression gets a lot better. When you stand them up on ultrasound, it gets a lot better. Or if you do the ultrasound on the iliac vein compression and don't see acceleration of blood flow through the iliac vein compression, or you don't see retrograde flow in the ipsilateral internal iliac vein, these may be findings that make you think that the left common iliac vein compression is not important. And the same logic can be used for the left renal vein in terms of looking at its anatomy and its physiology on ultrasound and using criteria that are in the literature, sort of have a lower pre-venography probability of those lesions being important. So that can focus your conversation with the patient. Also, the clinical presentation will focus your conversation a bit. So if you have a woman who comes in with chronic pelvic pain and she's 18 and never had any children, your conversation is going to be different than with somebody who's had 5 or 6 children, as we talked about earlier, and has evidence that the reflux on anatomy from the imaging is the main problem. Postmenopausal women tend to sort of lose any venous origin pain from reflux as they get older. It's not a hard and fast rule, but that seems to be true. And certainly even the varicosities in the pelvis, if you look at age quartiles, if you will, of patients, the diameters of the veins reduce after menopause. And so a postmenopausal woman who gives a history of pain since she was premenopausal and has a very significant iliac lesion and the reflux seems to be there, maybe more of a patient you would lean toward a conversation toward the iliac vein discussion. But it's always important to put in the context of the patient the other possible physiologic issues and recognize that there may be obviously findings during a venogram or even after embolization that may necessitate treating both conditions in a given patient.
So if the patient presents with pain and they have positive findings on, say, ultrasound and MRI, even with these dynamic maneuvers on ultrasound in clinic, do you still let them know, look, I'm still going to be checking with a venogram before I place any metal, you know, before I place any coils, before I place a stent, I'm still going to be checking. It's still something I need to confirm while we're in the procedure before I actually treat it. Are you telling them anything like that?
No, we definitely say that we're going to confirm. I think the more information you have beforehand will also influence how aggressively you need to confirm. So if you do a CT or an MRI or transabdominal ultrasound and you see the left common iliac vein has minimal compression, I think minimal confirmation is probably needed at the time of the procedure. Same with the left renal vein. But if you have somebody with compression that looks significant and you happen to even have physiologic evidence that compression is significant, retrograde left iliac vein, internal iliac vein flow, acceleration of flow in the lesion itself. Similar for the left renal vein, if you have physiologic evidence that it's more significant, then you'll be more aggressive and you'll certainly put a little bit more emphasis in the conversation with the patient that some of these things may need to be addressed, or maybe that's the only thing that needs to be addressed.
Sure. So you have an algorithm in your head as to, based off of the symptoms, the imaging findings, including these sort of dynamic maneuvers, as to which road you're going to take. So let's talk about the day of the procedure. The patient comes in. Obviously, you've educated them on what to expect. How do you approach these cases? Do you know I'm just going to coil today, or I may coil and stent today, or are you going to stage it?
Yeah. And it kind of depends a bit on what you know from the patient's history and what you know about their imaging. So there are going to be some where you enter the room and you know confidently there's no obstructive lesion in this patient. It's all reflux and we're going to deal with the reflux. And then there are other patients that you know the opposite. And then there are going to be a fraction of patients where there's a little bit of uncertainty and a small fraction where you really don't know and you may end up, most of the time we end up staging the treatments. Some make the argument that maybe you should just do it both, but I do think embolization has a longer track record and carries potentially less long-term potential risk to the patient. We certainly know stents perform very well from the data that's been collected for patients with lower extremity venous disorders, and the stents in the non-thrombotic patients have very high patencies. But there are some patients who get into a non-good cycle of having problems with their common iliac vein stents. And so you don't find as many sort of associated downsides with embolization. There are reported cases where patients think their coils are the cause of persistent pain, and coils are being removed by surgeons around the world for that specific issue. So we should keep that in mind as we see patients after we treat patients. And also, you'll see patients coming in with internet backgrounds, going to support group sites. And this was a very common, or this was a very popular conversation a few months ago on the pelvic sort of support group, pelvic pain support group on Facebook. And so, but I think the embolization as a rule is the safer thing to do long-term for the patient. And so I think with stenting, I think really think long and hard about who you're going to stent. And I really wouldn't stent somebody with a 50% diameter obstruction who also has reflux. And I would kind of reserve stenting for patients with more severe forms of obstruction who sort of fit into some of those groups we talked about where it makes more sense to stent.
Sure. Yeah. And sorry, I didn't mean to belabor the point. I just wanted to kind of cover your algorithm a little bit more in terms of that decision-making when you're approaching these oftentimes not straightforward cases, right? So let's talk about something that maybe is straightforward where you do have ovarian vein reflux and the plan is just to embolize. And then maybe after that, we'll walk through what the difference would be if you were planning on embolizing as well as stenting on the same day. Can you walk through that procedure, what the patient might expect, and also just how you perform those?
Yeah, what I tell the patient is it's going to be an outpatient. I think this is pretty standard outpatient procedure, some sedation. They probably need it more for anxiety care than actual pain, as we all know, and that they'll stay for an hour or so until the sedation's all over and they'll leave and the procedure might take an hour and a half or something like that, and that they kind of get back to their usual activity and they'll have a little bit of discomfort that non-steroidals generally can take care of over the subsequent few days, and that we would want them to come back and continue to follow with us to let us know how we've done and to have an open dialogue about any concerns they might have after the procedure. In terms of the steps on the day of the procedure, I think different people use different approaches to how to get into the veins and treat. I think increasingly the right internal jugular vein is being used, and that's what our main, if not only, approach is. Unless we're convinced that the patient's going to need only a stent, in which case either a high femoral, or some people will even use a saphenous origin to the left venous system, can be used. I think if you have really good imaging that shows that the lesion is simply a non-thrombotic lesion and it doesn't involve a long extent or any of the external iliac vein, you could use a common femoral vein approach ipsilateral to the side of the problem. In Europe, interestingly, a lot of reflux disease is treated by an arm access, usually a brachial, but could be a basilic vein access as well. It's harder to put IVUS catheters in because the length, it's going to be harder to stent, if at all possible, to stent from the arm or do IVUS. So, but just keep in mind that things may change as tools change. Maybe we'll be going from the arm more. And then from there, it really depends on what we think is the main problem. And we'll go from there. If there's some uncertainty about the venous system of the iliac vein, we might go right to an iliac vein venogram and prove that. One of my colleagues, now you mentioned him earlier, actually, Dr. Meisner, who's gotten very active in this area and is a great resource, actually does a balloon occlusion left internal iliac vein injection next after an external iliac vein injection. And he thinks that helps him understand the flow patterns a bit. We need to recognize it's not just what's big and the direction of flow, but also what the pattern of flow and how fast the flow is in different directions that can give insight. But generally, we'll do the iliac vein interrogation only in situations where we're really thinking that the iliac vein is potentially the main problem. Otherwise, we'll go right to the left renal vein and do a left renal venogram, make sure that the left renal vein is flowing well, that there's no significant evidence of obstruction. And in the straightforward cases where there's no concern, particularly when the pre-procedure imaging makes us feel more confident with that, selective left ovarian vein injection from somewhere above the left sacral ala, so you could see the multiple trunks that might exist in patients that fill the venous plexus. And we can get into more details after that, but as part of the venographic workup, I do think at some point, whether at the beginning or at the end, you also interrogate other potential connections to the pelvic venous reservoir, being the right ovarian vein and both internal iliac veins, even if the pre-procedural imaging doesn't suggest that there was right ovarian vein reflux.
You still do it at the end, even like post-embolization or stenting?
Yeah, and this is the logic behind it. It's partly based on the fact that I think it's important to certainly hear at the early stages of us trying to establish the value of embolization, or maybe even critical time, trying to establish the value of embolization for women with chronic pelvic pain, we should be as complete in our embolization as possible. And there's definitely literature out there. We really only have limited high-quality evidence. Most of the evidence that exists are case series. But if you look at the case series that do more thorough venography and more thorough embolization, you see greater improvements in visual analog scale pain severity, and you see better durability reported in terms of recurrent pain after the embolization. And so I think there is signal here that suggests a more thorough embolization is possible. So I'm a big believer in trying to sclerose the varicosities in the venous plexuses that are dilated and tortuous, probably hypertensive, much like the same way with getting rid of varicosities in the leg. I think the patients just feel better if you get rid of their varicosities in the leg in addition to ablating the saphenous vein that may be causing them. And I think in order to get a complete embolization, you need to get at it from all the possible ways that the reservoir can fill. And it can fill from the right ovarian, it can fill from both internal iliac veins. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the flow patterns change, just like when we do embolizations of vascular malformations, as you're doing the embolization. And you can consider the pelvic venous reservoir to be a low pressure venous malformation, if you will. And if you include the main reflexing pathway, the one that was the most hemodynamically impactful and that filled the reservoir immediately, let's say it's the left ovarian vein, you may find either on table or potentially a month or 3 months later that the right ovarian vein is now filling that reservoir if you left the reservoir there, or the internal iliac veins may be filling those reservoirs now. And so I think looking for all the sources and closing them off at this stage of our development of this procedure, both in terms of taking care of individual patients and trying to establish its validity in populations of patients anecdotally, and then in clinical and in scientific work, is important. We can always back off later after evidence shows that embolization is important by doing subsequent studies to see if maybe less embolization is just as good. But I think now we should do everything we can so that we don't leave patients needing to come back for subsequent procedures all the time because we said, well, we didn't do everything, because that's just not going to give the procedure a good name. Certainly in clinical studies, we're not going to show effect. And if we don't show effect, we're probably not going to get too many more cracks at trying to do that in the future.
Sure. So you talked about embolization and thorough embolization. Can you talk a little bit about your technique? You know, are you going from the right IJ access? Just talk through, are you coiling, packing the coils in layers? You know, the way I learned it was three different layers, putting some sclerosin agent in between. Can you talk about your technique and has that evolved over time?
Yeah, no, it has evolved over time. When I started to do these procedures, I did some in training and then I did some after training, and I was using only coils that I was only embolizing the left ovarian vein. And now it's evolved to being what I just described. What I think is a very good, inexpensive, and effective way to do this utilizes a longer sheath and a balloon occlusion tool. So is there a variety of balloon occlusion over the wire options that exist, but I don't think you need anything tremendously sophisticated. And so standard, put a long sheath in, do a standard left renal vein venogram with whatever catheter you think works best for you, and then do a angiographic catheter venogram of the left ovarian vein. And then I think advancing the sheath into the ovarian vein and exchanging for a balloon catheter and doing balloon occlusion venography gives a lot of benefits. First off, it gives you the ability to really appreciate the extent of the pelvic venous reservoir. You know, when you close off the flow and inject contrast in, you can fill the reservoir. In fact, what we do when we do that is we calculate the volume of the reservoir until we see spillage into either the iliac veins or the other ovarian vein. And that gives us an idea of how big the reservoir that you can fill from that ovarian vein is. And then it provides you with safety as you inject sclerosants. And we use a combination of either liquid sclerosant and contrast, or liquid sclerosant, contrast, and in a foam version to sclerose the pelvic venous reservoir using the volume of drug calculated or estimated from the estimated volume of the reservoir from the venogram. And then leaving the balloon up while the drug is in the pelvic venous reservoir for some length of time, and we arbitrarily say 5 minutes and actually try to adhere to that because it's very easy that 5 minutes seems like it goes quite fast, but it doesn't. It takes time to let the drug go in is really good. You could already be pushing coils through your balloon catheter. And what that does is not only increases the efficacy of the contact time of the drug with the veins, which we know makes a difference, but it also makes your coil deployment safer because there's no way your coils are going to migrate because you have a balloon above them. And then bring the balloon up a little higher and inject again. There are often parallel trunks. Usually the trunks end at about the top of the sacral ala, but there are some patients that have parallel ovarian trunks that are higher than that. And if you see them, depending on how big they are, you might actually dive into them and selectively balloon occlude those and sclerose those, or you might just put some coils in the origin, or if they're small, sclerose them from above with the balloon inflated again, above the coil pack that you have below and into the other parallel vein, and then put another coil pack in. And I think a coil pack every other vertebral body is a reasonable way to look at this, particularly from a cost point of view. I think the full metal jacket is overkill and may, if there is a signal to the fact that some coils can cause pain if they're poking through the side of the vein wall into the perivenous area, would mitigate against that. Keep in mind that these ovarian veins are very thin. You know, if you look at them in the operating room and see one with coils in it, you can see the coils inside the vein when you look at the vein from the outside. Same thing with the cava. The cava is a very thin structure too. And so it's not unreasonable to consider that pain can come from coils protruding through the side of the vein. So keep that in mind as you pack your coils. And then I think don't get too cute. Don't put coils too close to the renal vein and run the risk of either having the coil protrude into the renal vein or embolize to the systemic circulation. Give yourself a little bit of sort of room at the top to not make a mistake. And again, the balloon occlusion catheter is helpful here. You know, reinflate the balloon occlusion catheter and then deploy your coils and then take the balloon down and use the lumen of the balloon to do your completion venogram to see if you're done, and then you're done. There's been and I've done this before too, plugs are very appealing for this thing to occlude the left ovarian vein. Or the right ovarian vein. But there is an anecdotal case being described where an Amplatzer plug caused obstruction of the left ureter. And when you see them on scans, it's not crazy to think that that could happen. So keep that in mind with plugs and certainly with coil packs as well. As you know, I don't think it's probably a very common occurrence, but it's just something to think about. And then the same logic on the other side. You know, maybe the one nuance here is what to do with the ovarian vein that wasn't refluxing but fills varicosities in the pelvic venous reservoir when you do balloon occlusion venography on the right ovarian vein. And I think for sure you should do sclerosant with the balloon inflated on the other side as well. The coils, whether they help or not at that point is hard to know, but probably coiling the right ovarian vein on the way out is also good at this point in terms of until we know better is probably good practice. And then finally, doing balloon occlusion venography of the internal iliac veins to see if any varices are filling. You know, I think the more complete your balloon occlusion sclerotherapy is from the ovarian veins, the less varicosities you're going to see from the internal iliac venograms, which are balloon occlusion filling reservoir varicosities. If you're less complete, you're going to see more. And if you're more complete, you may only see a little bit, or more often our experience is we usually don't see anything there. Coils, I think, maybe as a caution, certainly in the main internal iliac vein trunk, veins are very distensible in different positions, different physiologic conditions like Valsalva, and coil and plug migration from the internal iliac circulation is much, much higher than it is from the ovarian vein circulation. I think in selected cases who have both venous origin chronic pelvic pain and have lower extremity varicose veins of pelvic origin, getting into the second or third order branches of the internal iliac vein and sclerosing and then putting coils in those veins to try to treat those escape points is reasonable. Just make sure you're packing your coils in a way that they're not going to migrate.
That's a really neat technique, Neil. It reminds me of BRTO with the balloon occlusion. I hadn't even heard of that before. I mean, that makes total sense, though, to use the balloon occlusion catheter to help protect, and that way you can really get that sclerosis to sit there for a little while. Was it borrowed by BRTO, or was it probably not? But I mean, it's just so, it makes so much sense now you hear it. I'm like, why did we do that back before? We were just like hoping that those coils didn't dislodge and pop up into the renal vein.
Yeah, no, I think it's borrowed from the venous and arterial vascular malformation experience. But I just want to call out Mel Rosenblatt. So he was an interventional radiologist who spent most of his time in Connecticut, academically at Yale, and then in private practice. And he really was the person who kind of brought this into the realm of venous origin chronic pelvic pain treatment. And so he passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. He was a very active member of the pelvic venous work group that we have that's addressing a lot of the research gaps in this area. And so a call out for him is due in terms of making this a more widespread approach to caring for patients with this problem.
Yeah, and I think it would just make you feel more confident that you're getting that sclerosis to sit there in there longer. And I imagine it reduces the need for detachable coils because you have that balloon there where you can place your coils. I mean, and like you said, to go back to cost, it will allow you to place non-detachable coils and then keep that balloon up and make sure everything looks, just to have that confidence, the same confidence that you get from a detachable, basically, right?
Absolutely. And I think that brings up a couple of issues. Certainly from a cost point of view, the 035 coils tend to be substantially cheaper than the microcatheters that you would use that are the more typical detachable ones, although there are detachable 035 coils. The other advantage of using pushable coils is that they're almost, if not all, fibered. And although there isn't much clinical evidence to say that fibered coils have an advantage in this particular indication, there are certainly animal studies that have been done. Sarah White, the group from Penn in Wisconsin, published recently on this, that there's a better rate of occlusion when you use fibered coils than non-fibered coils in veins. And so it makes sense. And then obviously in the OBL, where everything you use has cost, the cheapest possible coil, which is typically is the pushable fibered coil, goes a long way to meeting your bottom line. And so using a balloon catheter is a lot cheaper with the fibered coils, as a lot cheaper than using multiple detachable coils. But time will tell. You know, the advantage of the detachable microcatheter coils is that they're very soft. And so these pack nicer and there's less edges or ends sticking into the wall of the vein. And so if we have signal with pain coming from the ends of these coils, then probably the ideal coil would be a really soft, fibered, inexpensive coil that you can push through a balloon catheter. And that's sort of where we would probably get to.
Sure. Well, thank you for sharing that. Any tips? I mean, you kind of already covered most of this, but, you know, we're talking about tips for difficult anatomy and any other sort of challenges or complications to avoid when you're placing your sclerosing as well as placing these coils. Anything we left out?
I think we talked about the internal iliac vein. Just be cautious. I think most interventional radiologists are pretty cognizant of this, but I think there are other vascular specialists who are involved in this, and it's important for us to keep talking about that concern so that they don't have to learn from the mistakes that others had learned years before. Same with the coil in the left renal vein. Just be really careful about your highest coil and make sure that last highest coil is your most secure coil, sort of anchor coil, if you will. And anchor type coils may have a role in that particular location when you're using a balloon, because you can protect your first coil, but your last coil, eventually you have to take down your balloon, and we don't want that one to migrate. Difficult anatomy, most of the patients are fairly straightforward. You know, there are going to be some patients that, for whatever reason, you feel like you need to do a redo, and some of the redos can be quite complicated because of the way that the veins come back. Redos seem to be much more common with scrotal embolization than they have with ovarian embolizations, but maybe with time we'll see more redos on the ovarian vein. And then the particular tricky one might be the retroaortic left renal vein, what to do about that, if you think it's obstructed or not, and then the combined compressive patient with the combined reflex patient, how to manage those patients. I think those are the sort of tricky situations that we get into.
Well, great. You know, we've already talked for an hour, and I know we've covered a lot, but I did want to get to post-procedure care and follow-up. When are you seeing these patients again? How are you meeting expectations? What are those kind of conversations like the day of the procedure when you send them home, but also next time you see them?
Yeah, no, we usually try to get them to come back pretty soon just for the standard routine. So there's usually some 2 to 4 week follow-up. Certainly keeping an open dialogue with them. They all have our contact information. If there's a problem at the puncture site or they're having pain, which may be the two concerns that are the most common that we hear about in the post-procedure period, we can usually manage those either over the phone or with a quick visit in the office earlier than that. But generally, the expectations we give them is that this may not make a big difference right away, so be patient. There are certainly some patients that will, and I'm sure all the audience who does this will have patients that'll say that, you know, they'll go see patients in their recovery room and the patient will already say they feel better. And there's a lot of reasons for that, why that may be happening. And one of them may be that they actually do feel better. And some patients feel better very quickly. But for others, it can take time. If you look at the sort of visual analog scale curve of pain versus time that was recently published in JVIR by Di Gregorio and colleagues, I think they treated 520 patients with coil embolization only, and they use coils in all four vessels, the internal iliac veins bilaterally, as well as the ovarian veins bilaterally. They showed a very dramatic reduction in the visual analog pain score, but it took months for that to happen. And they saw their patients at 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and 12 months. And if you look at the curve, the pain was going down even beyond 6 months. The majority of the pain had reduced at 3 months, but there was still a substantial amount of pain getting better at 6 months. So patients should be apprised of the fact that it might take some time for them to feel better. And there's a lot of potential reasons for that, but it's certainly an observation that's worth sharing with them.
Sure. Yeah. And so are you following that same follow-up schedule, or is yours a little bit different?
Ours is a little bit different. You know, I think many of these patients are also seeing other consultants for other things. So they may still be doing their pelvic floor therapy. They may still be doing, you know, seeing the PM&R patients for doctors for injections and their gynecologists who referred them. But we keep in contact with them. Video visits have been a nice way to, because there's not much to see in many of these patients, video visits is a nice way to manage that. We find that the patients tend to call us more than in follow-up, more than other patients might. We have patients who get treated for other conditions. These patients tend to call more. You know, we have to recognize that persistent pain could be because we didn't completely treat what was venous in etiology. And so, you know, there certainly are some patients where you need to rethink them from a venous point of view. But if you really thoroughly worked them up ahead of time, clearly made the decision and had no other venous issues, like a concurrent obstruction in the clinical picture, and you think you did a complete embolization, and that's one of the other reasons to advocate for doing complete reservoir ablation in addition to four-vessel venography and embolization, then other causes of pain could be present too. Now, sometimes those other causes are organic causes, like, you know, maybe patient had concurrent endometriosis or had something else. They could have secondary pain. It's very common for central sensitization to occur, and they can have other pain generators that are apparent but not real that also need to be dealt with. So maybe, you know, I don't know this is going to be true, but maybe the frequent association with symptoms of pelvic floor myalgia in women with venous origin chronic pelvic pain may be related to central sensitization causing pelvic floor pain, or even causing painful bladder syndrome. That's another association that's frequently seen in patients with venous origin chronic pelvic pain. And those symptoms may persist after treatment because the central sensitization is there. If I may diverge for just 1 second, Aaron, just on one additional topic, there was an interesting presentation at CIRSE in a recent paper that I'm the editor of the journal Phlebology, so we just recently accepted it, by Dr. Smith in the Chicago area and his colleagues in a large interventional radiology practice there. They reported on 45 consecutive pelvic venous patients that they had, which were being treated for venous origin chronic pelvic pain. And they assessed these patients for concurrent problems. And they found, using questionnaires for painful bladder syndrome, the PUF questionnaire, which is pelvic pain and urinary frequency, a standard interstitial cystitis painful bladder syndrome questionnaire, a very high rate of patients with symptoms that would classify them as severely affected with that condition in the patients, in the 45 patients they were treating for venous origin chronic pelvic pain. Similarly, they found a very high rate of symptomatic orthostatic hypotension in those patients in a class that would be considered severe. They found a lot of hypermobile patients in that group, EDS, Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, patients and patients with hypermobility syndrome, and a very high proportion of patients had irritable bowel or met criteria for irritable bowel syndrome. After they did the embolization, they readministered the questionnaires for the painful bladder syndrome, interstitial cystitis, and the orthostatic hypotension to those patients, and they saw dramatic decreases in the severity of the symptoms reported on those questionnaires with regard to the orthostatic patients at the same level that the best possible treatment for orthostatic hypotension, which is saline infusions weekly, can cause. So there's some interesting data here to sort of tickle your mind. You know, it's nothing conclusive at this point, but it certainly gets at the possible commonality of potentially etiology of maybe these conditions, chronic pelvic pain and interstitial cystitis and orthostatic hypotension, but certainly the coexistence of these symptoms, which may, at least at 6 month follow-up, and to some extent, these patients were also followed at a year, improvement in these associated symptoms. So that's information to come in the future. You'll see this paper published in Phlebology in the next probably month or so online.
Yeah, that was my next question, was any resources or papers you recommend to our audience to, like you were saying, kind of tickle their interest to delve deeper, or even for the, you know, we started very basic at the beginning, any, even for people who are looking to get started, maybe having these patients present to them, they're not quite sure where to get started to get all the information they need to really fully address this problem.
Yeah, we recently submitted, and it will be published in the very near future, a review article on this that covers a lot of the stuff that I talked about. And my co-authors were Ron Winokur, Jimmy Shi, who is one of our residents, and Mark Meisner. And it will be published in CVIR, hopefully online in the next 3 months or so. It's still under review, but it was an invited article, so I fully expect it. So that will be a review article to look for probably in the next, let's say, 1 to 3 months. I think reading the paper that describes the SVP classification, SVP is an acronym for symptoms, varices, and pathophysiology. That paper was concurrently published in Phlebology and the Journal of Vascular Surgery, Venous and Lymphatic Diseases. I think that has a nice summary article. And then we had a paper in JVIR back in, I think, 2019 that reviewed the research consensus panel on pelvic venous disorders and what the research goals or gaps are and where we should be going. And that was in JVIR. And I think that's a good one. We're just in progress now with a study. We're recruiting patients to develop a patient-reported outcome as a tool to be used. It's a disease-specific patient-reported outcome measure tool for pelvic venous or venous origin chronic pelvic pain. That was a research gap identified from the RCP funded by SAR Foundation, as is the project to develop the tool. We hope that will become as impactful a tool as the tool that we use for fibroids, which was also developed by interventional radiologists, the tool developed by Jim Spies. And then we also have, funded by the SIR Foundation with some generous support from VIVA and from the American Vein and Lymphatic Society Foundation, as well as an unrestricted grant, which was quite generous from Penumbra, to do a randomized control trial of embolizations using the technique that I just described as the more thorough technique with sham control. So half the patients are going to get venography and then not know that they haven't had an embolization, and half the patients will have an embolization. We'll follow them for 6 months and see how they do, both in terms of visual analog scale improvement, as well as hopefully the patient-reported outcome measure will be ready by the time the patients are being randomized. And then some exploratory questionnaires will be used, including the orthostatic hypotension questionnaire and the PUS one for interstitial cystitis. And so we hope that study will give us a lot of insights into how well we're doing. We're very kind of fingers crossed that it will, but we're certainly, you know, working with the null hypothesis that there'll be no difference. And so it'll be a very rigorous study. And again, funded generously by SIR Foundation and listed in clinicaltrials.gov. If you're interested in referring patients to the study, it's completely funded. The patients do not have to pay anything for any part. And there's a crossover option for the patients who end up in the control group at 6 months and are still in pain. So if you have patients who are having trouble getting insurance coverage, refer them to our study. Ron Winokur is the PI on that study, and you could find us either on the internet or through clinicaltrials.gov to refer patients to it.
Fantastic, Neil. Thank you so much. You shared so much today. I'm looking forward to getting this one out. Any last word? Anything else that we left behind? I know it's a lot to cover in a, you know, 1 hour podcast.
No, I think we need to be aware that our data is definitely sending strong signals that there is effects for embolization and probably also for stenting in selected patients. But selecting the patients well requires that you're not just a dabbler, that you really get into this literature, I think, really understand venous origin, chronic pelvic pain, and lower extremity varicosities. Recognize that most lower extremity varicosities of pelvic origin don't need embolization, something we didn't get into. Only a very small fraction of patients will, most of the time just treating the varicosities, particularly including treatment near the escape points and the legs, will be sufficient. And then develop relationships with your colleagues in other specialties here. You know, certainly welcome referrals, but also refer patients to them as well. Not all the patients are going to fit perfectly with a venous origin pain, or some of them will have pain after you treat them. And use your consultations to help the patient, but also to develop your sort of reputation in your community for being somebody who's thoughtful and doesn't think everything that looks like a nail needs a hammer that we have, and that sometimes their tools are needed as well. And recognize that many times patients will have multiple pain generators in that, or even secondary problems like depression and central sensitization and catastrophizing that may need mental health providers to help as well. So those are sort of my take-home parting comments.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck,
Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manveer Singh Sudley.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening. The content, information, opinions, and viewpoints contained in this podcast presentation are for educational purposes only. Some opinions expressed may represent those of the speaker and are based on their own clinical experience in their practice. This information is not meant or intended to serve as a substitute for a healthcare professional's clinical training, experience, or judgment. Guest speakers are paid consultants of Cook Medical. Always refer to the instructions for use for complete prescribing information, including indications for use, warnings, precautions, adverse events, and deployment instructions.